Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone, and welcome to Come for Supper. I'm Alexandra Dudley, food writer, cook, and serial dinner party host. So I thought it'd be fun to sit down with people who share that love for food, chat about life, and learn a little bit more about how they like to serve supper. I speak to chefs, restaurateurs, artists, actors, authors, and pretty much anyone who likes to entertain. If you're new to the podcast, make sure you click subscribe. And if you enjoy it, rate it, review it, share it, and tell your friends, as it makes all the difference. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. My guest today is an award-winning chef, restaurateur, and food writer. His first cookbook, The Natural Cook, celebrates root-to-fruit eating, making the most of ingredients and working with the seasons. And his second book, Eating for Pleasure, People, and Planet, will be out later this year. He is also founder and executive chef of Poco Tapas Bar and the moving sustainable supper club and social enterprise Forgotten Feast. He has a weekly food waste column in The Guardian and writes for other publications, including The Telegraph, Foodism, and Vegetarian Living. His dedication to environmentalism has placed him at the forefront of change makers, raising awareness around the global climate change crisis. And hence, he is often found giving talks, demonstrations, and consulting those on how to reduce waste and protect our food system. He is the ever talented and inspiring Tom Hunt.
Thank you so much. What an incredible introduction.
Well, I always think you never introduce yourself like that. So it's quite nice to have someone else do it, you know, once in a while. And actually, I could have gone on and I thought about it this morning. I was like, oh, is it a bit long? I mean, I could actually make it longer. There's a lot more to talk about there. So how are you and where have you come from today?
I'm great, thanks. I've just come from Damien Clisby's restaurant, A Meal Round the Corner.
Nice. How was it?
I had a long, slow lunch on my own.
Good.
Whilst I waited.
So indulgent.
This. Yeah. It was happenstance that led to me being there. I didn't realise it was just on the corner from your studio.
Perfect.
So I had an amazing...
What did you have?
Celeriac salad, which I thought was my pasta dish because it came in these huge sheets that looked like pasta.
Oh, amazing.
But of celeriac dressed with seps and hazelnut, and it was
Yum.
Really good.
So good. So autumnal. So I want to dive right in because I think it's something that needs to be part of a bigger conversation. First of all, I guess, for those who perhaps don't know much about it, what is food waste and why is it something that we need to work on reducing and preventing?
Well, food waste happens at every level of the food industry or every part of the food chain, from the field to the fork or our bins. And it needs tackling because, as most of us now know, we're wasting at least a third of the food that we produce, and that is creating huge carbon emissions and not just carbon emissions, everything else that goes with it. Essentially, when we're thinking about waste, we should be thinking about all of the resources and energy that have gone into producing that food, from the chemicals that are put on the fields or not, depending on the type of farming, to the transportation, the labor, and everything else. And then, of course, after it's scraped off our plates into the bin, it then continues to create kind of really harmful kind of methane gases, which are 30 times stronger than carbon dioxide, and really damaging for the ozone. I also see food waste as really a gateway for us to discuss about these kind of broader issues of climate change.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there, and we're gonna talk lots about it. But first of all, I just want to go a little bit back into your personal journey. So you work a lot with food now, but did it always interest you? Were you kind of like a foodie baby? Were you into it when you were little?
I was. There's a great picture of me just with my arms out wide, like I'm about 3 years old in my grandma's kitchen with a kind of plastic apron and just this huge mess in front of me, like trying to cook.
I love that. I love that. I used to try and make pancakes in the bathroom with flour and milk and eggs and no, and didn't quite realise that you needed heat to make them. So just used to kind of flip raw batter everywhere, and which is why we were confined to the bathroom. So can you perhaps share one of your earliest kind of food memories?
Well, so being a foodie child or a food loving child, I was gifted a copy of the Usborne First Cookbook, which is this brilliant cookbook that many people may have had or read as a child, with these strange little kind of mini chefs that run around the page kind of building different recipes. And so I used that cookbook and basically cooked everything in it at the age of 7 or 8.
Wow.
Including like baklava, potato skins, like
brownies. Because I was going to think, is it like scones and butterfly cupcakes?
Scones, lots of those sorts of things.
Okay, but baklava is quite, I mean, you know, it's hot. Is it safe for a 7-year-old?
Yeah, well, I think so.
Yeah.
I think it's good to get your kids in the kitchen. That's my plan with my new daughter. She's 6 months old. I'm thinking, how is she going to eat? What's she going to eat?
Oh. Cooking is so fun, I think, when you're a kid, to be honest. All my great memories are of that. And what was it that brought you into kind of food as a career? Where did that start?
So, like, although I had this kind of intense passion for food, I was also kind of... I don't want to say a talented artist, but...
No, say it.
I was basically... As a child, I was praised for two things. Not for sport, but I was
likewise
praised on my cooking and my art and my drawing. So I ended up going to art college and studied fine art in Falmouth University. And art's still a passion for me now. And I'm now actually wondering how I can bring that back into the work I'm doing. But at the same time, I was always passionate about food. And so when I left university, I was like, okay, I need to cook. I need to travel. What's next? And ended up landing this great job, earned some cash and fled to the Americas and spent a year traveling around Central America.
Wow. And then?
And then, America, like Central America was a big part of kind of my kind of coming into to food as well, because whilst I was there, I was working at an Argentinian grill in Honduras, which was just fascinating. I was actually working as a waiter.
Okay, front of house.
Yeah. I've had a couple of waiting jobs, and that was just amazing because it was a Caribbean. My tables were on the beach.
Wow.
Which was
bliss.
It was on the island of Roatan.
Wow,
where
I've never
we were
been,
diving.
I have to say. Okay.
I was kind of diving 3 times a day and then working this Argentinian grill in the evening. But the grill, and I mean, at the end of the day, Argentinians are masters of the grill.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I was just like a sponge, kind of watching the chef, chatting to him, writing down notes and gathering kind of ideas and techniques for how to cook. Which was just immensely inspiring before returning back to the UK to kind of continue working at the music festivals where I've kind of always worked.
Lots of demos and
actually,
well.
No, I set up a festival cafe.
Oh, okay.
So basically kind of whilst I was at university cooking, drawing,
yeah,
making paintings. I was also in between working at the music festivals in the summers.
Okay, cool.
Like Glastonbury, Bestival, and cooking with a friend, Ben Hodges, which we were just cooking the most incredible food, but at a festival.
Great.
From
and scratch.
It's
so like good food. Because
really
I mean,
good
you can
food.
Find great food now at festivals because I think that music and foods come together. But back then it was, I remember going to Reading and stuff and it was, I used to eat waffles. I eat a lot of waffles. Otherwise, it was like chips.
I wonder if it's still the same at Reading, but I mean, the food we cooked was brilliant. Like it, like we were Soil Association certified organic.
Wow.
And We cooked everything from scratch. The chef was formerly from the River Cafe.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
So, yeah, this is 97 and we were cooking good food. It did happen.
And when was it that you kind of took notice of wastage, and when did that? Because that's a huge part of the way that you cook, and I think it's something you're so good at kind of celebrating, just celebrating it, not making it this kind of downer, but just making all of the food, the entirety of the ingredients, I think taste great. And when was it that you kind of took note and made that happen?
It was most certainly when Tristram Stewart's team, the Tristram Stewart, the author of Waste, mm-hmm. and really the guy I think who is kind of mostly responsible for opening our eyes to the global food waste scandal. His team invited me to create a banquet on Southwark Bridge using food waste. This is 2010-11. And I was just gobsmacked by the incredible produce that we received for the banquet. And it kind of evolved into this social enterprise called The Forgotten Feast, which was a campaign for sustainable food through celebration and dining and kind of creating conversations around the table through putting the solutions on the table, quite mm-hmm. literally cooking with that waste or fish discards or whatever it was. And so at that point, I was like, right, that's it. I need to change the way that I operate and think about food. And I mean, I had already been prioritizing climate cuisine within the way I cook.
Climate cuisine, I like that. Climate cuisine.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Good old thing. I also like the word veg-centric.
Yeah, yeah.
Another good one.
Or I say plant-focused or plant-rich.
Plant-focus is nice.
Plant-rich is my new
one. Plant-rich is great.
So the book subtitle is Plant-Rich, Zero Waste Climate Cuisine.
Great. Ooh, nice. All of them. All of them in there.
All of them.
Love it.
Pack them in.
Okay. Gosh, that's amazing that you cooked at that. Was that after the feeding of the 5,000, the Leicester Trafalgar Square?
Yeah, he'd done one the year before. I was involved with one that year.
Yeah.
And helped and did cookery demonstrations and just got involved. But it was kind of an inspiring time, really. Like, everything was hitting the headlines. I was invited onto Sky News for the first time. And it was kind of like, yeah, kind of an interesting time for the food sustainability revolution.
Yeah, and you were a real kind of real early adopter of it. So flash forward, 2011, we're in Bristol, and I know that you've done the festivals, you've done the feasts, and I also read the other day that Bristol is the most sustainable city in the UK and apparently has like the highest rate of vegetarianism and veganism and kind of plastic-free living. But at the time, did people get what you were doing? Did they get the whole concept of what you guys were trying to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you say, Bristol's quite a conscious city and open to that kind of thing. But I'd say that it's sustainability kind of is new in its branding, but it's been around for a long time.
Yeah.
I've certainly grown up kind of in that mm-hmm. environment through being vegetarian and working on farms and permaculture farms. And yeah, so it's always been a part of my life. And permaculture is a really interesting kind of philosophy of food sustainability for anyone interested.
So what
to check out.
For people who don't know what permaculture is, what can you explain it?
So it's a food philosophy and way of farming or gardening that is has a kind of, well, if you break the word down, perma and culture would be like permanent culture, as mm-hmm. in it can sustain itself. So it's kind of living and breathing food sustainability.
Putting it back into the, kind of putting things back
into
the earth. Yeah,
so there'll be, there's lots of, within the philosophy, there's lots of kind of buzzwords and ideas that you'd already have heard of through food sustainability. Like one of their key mottos is produce no waste. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand about the gardening itself, it's certainly organic and low input. So low input meaning they very much favour perennials. So there's two kind of key types of plants, annuals and perennials. Annuals are your most plants, like, and your cereals or grains that need to be ploughed and planted each year, whereas perennials are things like asparagus and rhubarb, but berries, fruit trees, and other plants that, or bushes or shrubs that stay in the ground. And what you get a lot of benefits from farming in that way, because you're not ploughing up the soil and releasing carbon into the atmosphere. There's much less manual labour as well.
Yeah.
And you're still producing kind of great food whilst improving the quality of the soil at the same time and locking and sequestering carbon. So it's kind of one of the key parts of the permaculture philosophy. I should say I'm not a permaculture expert either. I have lived on a permaculture farm, but I'm still kind of learning myself about it. It's a really interesting subject.
I was speaking to someone else the other day who's growing an edible forest, and I asked kind of what that was, and she was talking about it's a kind of similar concept, but it's where you can kind of create this land that you can, everything will be edible, but like trees, nuts, fruits, bushes, and it's that whole kind of...
Yeah, so agroforestry.
You're not pulling stuff up as well. You're kind of leaving it in there and letting it do its thing. Maybe I should become a permaculture expert.
Definitely.
Okay, so let's chat entertaining then. Do you like to entertain? I know that you're a busy man. You cook, you do a lot of different cooking for lots of different people. Do you like to entertain?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I became a chef. As I was growing up, I just found like whenever there was a party or something, my place was in the kitchen. And that was the way that I contributed to the event. And then that continued into kind of cooking for people and doing events like through the Forgotten Feast and elsewhere.
It's really rewarding. It's interesting what you said when you were young about there were two things that you were kind of applauded for, like good at, and I really empathize with that, because the two things that I was good at were either entertaining people, like acting or dancing or cooking, and they were it's such a tangible thing. There's such an element of kind of achievement when you've cooked something and people are there going or even just eating it. It's a great feeling. So can you talk me through a bit of an evening? What are your kind of your signature moves when you're entertaining?
Well, I'm quite a practical person, so I like to prepare things in advance. Almost to the point where I don't have to do anything when the guests arrive.
Yeah. Key to a great host, that. It's all about the prep.
And then I think a really good cocktail or some natural wine.
Natural arrival. Wine. Delicious.
Of course, natural wine kind of fits in with the rest of my kind of holistic root to fruit philosophy. And then I was kind of actually thinking about some different dishes that I might cook.
Oh yeah, tell me.
And I thought, yeah, I mean, everything for me at the moment is about eating for pleasure, people and planet, and the new cookbook. So it's actually a plant-based cookbook, but it doesn't ignore meat eaters. So there's actually quite a large section in the book about how to eat meat well, but then the recipes are all plant-based, so that it's accessible for everyone, but also kind of educational, because it's not your usual cookbook. It's got a lot of...
It's not a book for vegetarians.
Yeah, and it's not just a cookbook. It's like got a lot of information about how you can eat for personal and planetary health. But the recipes are plant-based, as I was saying, and the one that I keep coming back to at the moment, and I've cooked at several events already, is... So I love world food through my kind of travel experiences, but it's always kind of with these... kind of with local fresh produce. And so the starter I like to make at the moment is a repas, or Venezuelan corn
cakes. So delicious.
And they're so good. And you can make them with like blue corn or like different kind of interesting maize meal. And then I've been stuffing them with this, with pulled oyster mushrooms and a homemade barbecue sauce with a salsa made from kohlrabi and dried mangoes.
Wow.
And it's just like...
Taste explosion.
It is. And it's... Dried mangoes are a new one for me, because although I cook with only seasonal British produce, fresh produce, I like to use kind of dried world ingredients. Mm-hmm. And so the a mango is normally off my shopping list.
Yeah.
And I've never thought about adding dried mangoes before, but they worked so well.
Yeah, clever.
They just rehydrated into the salsa and just were like, pow, in terms of colour and flavour.
Amazing.
And just completely wonderful.
So delicious. Okay, so are you a kind of a starter main pudding man? Bit of sharing.
Yes and no. I mean, I like, I'm a feaster.
A feaster. Okay, cool.
Tom's
like that.
Feast.
Yeah.
So my business is called Tom's Feast, and that's for a reason. I mean, and for the Forgotten Feast.
Feast.
So it's like, it's all, I mean, food's about community and kind of gathering around the table. So the more you can share food, the better. And so often that might just mean, put an amuse-bouche on the table, like some kind of ceviche or something like that. Or just throw everything on the table at once and just have that kind of...
Dive in.
That kind of... Everyone can dive in. And also that's what gives you that kind of feasting, the feel of celebration.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd kind of go everything all in, I think.
Yeah.
I might do like... In terms of preparation for a banquet, I might plate an amuse-bouche ready
so that
when the guests arrive, it's done and they can nibble whilst you kind of get everything else together.
To throw it all together. So will you try and push something to kind of showcase that zero waste eating that perhaps people wouldn't think of when you're kind of curating a menu? Because I know that it's something that you push, or do you not even think about it? Does it just sort of happen?
I mean, root to fruit eating is... kind of, I'd say, an holistic approach to food. And that means everything from thinking about how it affects your health and the health of the planet through the way that it was produced. But it also means cooking with the ingredient quite literally holistically. So using the whole ingredient whenever you're cooking. So in some ways... it's something that I don't think about. Like, I wouldn't, although my Guardian column comes up with ideas and recipes for using the odds and ends of different ingredients, when I cook, I actually try and just incorporate those into the dish, whatever.
Yeah.
So, I would never peel anything. Mm. I'd always use the stalks.
Especially
there wouldn't
you're
be a
using
question.
Organic always and stuff, aren't you?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's something I've come to recently. I used to just kind of be more whimsical about eating the skins of anything. But actually, the more I understand and learn about organic agriculture, the more and or chemicals in terms of like the residues and fungicides that are left on produce, the more important I realise that it is to peel non-organic or not non-organic necessarily, but heavily sprayed vegetables. But I mean, another kind of one of my favorite recipes that I would serve at a banquet would be the Pulp Fiction burger, which is this brilliant kind of pink burger made with juice pulp, and like it's
Yum.
A winter, it's in the
Beetroot
winter section
pulp.
So it's filled with like bright pink radicchios and it's made with tempeh and walnuts and juice pulp, and it's kind of flavoursome and delicious. Another thing I might do is this kind of another great invention I've just managed to come upon is a winter Caesar salad. So again, winter leaves, huge sourdough croutons, and then aquafaba Caesar dressing. So you'd like... make it, I mean, Caesar dressing is kind of like a mayonnaise anyway. So you can switch the eggs out with aquafaba chickpea water and then whiz it up and add some kind of extra umami kind of seaweed and capers or miso and things like that to kind of start kind of ramping it up in that to replace the anchovies and kind of create a more kind of... or seriously flavoursome.
You've veganified it as well.
Yeah.
For people who are vegan, you've done that as well.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I mean, there's an ongoing argument about kind of how sustainable it is to eat meat. And so I've decided to just kind of stay on this. I'm not one for being in grey areas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In terms of the way that we run our restaurant, Poco, and the way that I operate in terms of my writing and communication is to stick with the scientists and stay out of the grey areas and just be kind of, well, it's a bit dramatic to say on the right side of history, but what I mean is it's great to, like, for me, I can just, if I hear that cod isn't a great sustainable species, but it is if you get it from this specific sea, trawled in this specific way, I'll just stay clear of it.
Okay.
And I won't take any risks in terms of the sustainability of the produce that I'm using or communicating to use, because I don't see any point, because there's such a great diversity.
Yeah, we're so lucky with ingredients
of sustainable products that we can use. Yeah.
I think it forces you to be creative as well, sometimes, those limitations.
Big
I always say,
time.
Like, to eat seasonally as well. It's just, first of all, go on Google. It's really simple. People are often ask, like, how do you do it? How do you find out what's in season? I'm like, go on Google. It's the easiest thing. Speak to your greengrocer or speak to, or, you know, follow someone who knows what they're doing. And
or
then
look
just
at the
stick.
Origin label on the packaging in the supermarket.
You know, asparagus from Peru.
In the supermarket.
But,
the,
you know, and it's, it, you know, you start eating things that maybe you wouldn't eat, things like swede. Who knew how much I love swede? I would never have cooked swede if I hadn't just, you know, really thought, what else can I eat, you know, that's in season that I haven't eaten right now?
Yeah. Yeah, so a big part of eating for pleasure, people and planet, is supporting biodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, we've seen, like, 60% more kind of biodiversity loss. Biodiversity loss is accelerated by 600 to 1,000 times more than it should have in the last kind of 50 years. And these statistics are all based around the fact that we're farming badly and that we're destroying, like, through agriculture, we're destroying the wildlife and local environment. And so, but we can support all of those things through eating seasonally and diversifying our diets agriculturally as well. And through eating that better food.
So let's talk a little bit about disasters. I know that you've done lots of cooking, lots of demos, but has there ever been a time when things just went wrong? I mean, you probably fixed it, but...
Yeah, well, so I created the first banquets at Wilderness Festival.
That's very cool. I did not know that. Very cool.
They were very cool. With my friend Jenna and... So I was actually organizing the food for all three nights, but Friday night was me, Saturday night was Morrow,
cool,
and then Sunday night was Sky Gingell.
Great.
And so I was kind of helping curate the food and cooking it with my team and their head chefs. But on the Friday night, we were serving my starter, which was a spring soup of just a very simple soup of the best organic vegetables available. And they were all from Dalesford Organics.
Mm-hmm.
And about halfway through serving the 300 guests, we realized we probably only had enough soup for 250 people.
God.
And it was just one of those moments where you're like, there's not, like, you just have to react. You can't break down. And it was like, okay, we've got to make this soup now. And so we just got kind of split half the team off and they made
another
50 portions of soup out of what we had left.
Gosh,
so
that
it was a little bit thin compared to the first
thin soup. Thinned it out, adding all the water to it. I think I've done worse than that.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I was interviewing Doug McMaster the other day, and he said something that was really simple, but it had a lot of weight, which was just that things change when we realise that food is precious. And this morning I was reading through bits that you've written, and there's one line, I think it was in an article you wrote for Vegetarian Living, and it kind of struck that same chord, which is when you said, food tastes better when it's made with care. And I know that we've chatted a little bit more about the book, but if you were kind of, you know, if you were kind of talking to your average Joe on the street about, you know, why to, I guess, not buy into you, but why to believe and believe in what you're doing and buy into the book, what would you say?
That's pretty tough. I mean, I'd say that I've kind of lived and worked in food sustainability for all of my life. I've been cooking for 20 years and working in and around food sustainability experts for the last 10 years. And with a great passion for and core belief that we should have a fairer food system, mm-hmm. that supports everyone, from the people in the fields to those that can't necessarily afford a good meal. And all of that kind of energy and the culmination of my work over the last 10 years in terms of root fruit eating and communicating these ideas all culminates in this cookbook.
Top three recipes from the cookbook.
Top three recipes, mm-hmm. that I haven't mentioned.
Yeah, that you haven't mentioned.
Okay, so skipping to the dessert section, olive oil brioche.
Yum.
Which is egg-free and made with whole wheat.
So it's vegan as well?
Yeah, so
wow,
the whole book's actually vegan.
The whole book's vegan. Okay, wow.
But as I said earlier, it's kind of like from this kind of perspective that we should eat more plants, mm-hmm. and if you're going to eat meat, this is how you can do it.
Yeah, okay.
But I was just astonished by the, developing the recipe and finding that you can make whole wheat, egg-free olive oil brioche, because really brioche
is butter.
Is egg, butter, yeah. And like white flour, but it was really is really delicious. And then it's topped with plant yogurt. There's some recipes for plant yogurt in the
Great.
Back, just made with nuts and stuff. It's more easy than you could ever imagine, and rhubarb, and then baked in the oven. It's like this kind of gooey kind of brioche tart.
Delicious.
And then, I mean, what's another one? The I've mentioned oyster. There's a summer vegetable ceviche, which I love. I love kind of
fresh,
those fresh kind of Peruvian flavors, and the tiger's milk of lime and chilies, and that's mixed through kind of purple potatoes, which kind of steps into the idea of biodiversity. Mm-hmm. Oyster mushrooms, which are a hero, an environmental hero, because they're again in the kind of permaculture concept, low input. So they can be grown in cities on recycled products like coffee grounds or wood shavings and things like that. So they're a really interesting kind of sustainable ingredient to play around with
and delicious. Yeah, really delicious.
And then, I mean, the other one that's coming to mind right now, which doesn't like normally kind of stand out, but it's one of the first recipes in the book, and it's a brunch. So one of the interesting things about writing the book was learning how to make brunch without eggs.
Because
I'm
such
so
a staple.
Like for me, you know, brunch is all about eggs. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to kind of like challenge that and come up with some new recipes. So there's this one brunch dish, which is like pretty as anything, whipped butter beans with grilled wild garlic and rose duca.
Yum.
And then some fried mushrooms. And on the day we had some like chicken of the woods, morels, and some other kind of like little bluets or something.
So good.
And it was just kind of like this kind of realization that you don't have to have eggs for a nice brunch.
Yeah, yeah. When it's March that it comes out, isn't it? So exciting. Okay, so when you aren't cooking and when you aren't, I guess, eating at home, where do you like to eat? Kind of Bristol, London? I know that's where you spend most of your time.
Yeah, I mean, recently with a newborn, we haven't been out quite as much. So it's local places. And the best Indian I've had is Ganapati's in Peckham.
Okay,
cool. They've been there for 20 years or something, but they're incredible.
Family run?
Yeah. And it's just not like any other Indian. But it's not pretentious. They do delivery.
Great, handy with the baby.
But the restaurant's great, and actually, for some reason, more economical to eat there than it is to get the takeaway.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, it's funny, but it's so delicious. Where else? I mean, I'm a big fan of Damien Clisby and Emil around the corner because he was heading up Petersham for many years, and we worked together a lot because we have quite similar ideas around what food should be, and so I'm kind of big in for supporting Emil and his new kind of venture.
I need to go. Everyone who's been has said it's great.
Yeah, it's just, again, unpretentious, really comforting, incredible tasting food.
I've got to go. So I like to bring it back into the kitchen to end. Top three ingredients that you advise people to always have in the kitchen?
Sauerkraut, kefir and kombucha.
Wow. Off the norm. Sauerkraut 100%. Kombucha, do you brew your own?
Yeah.
I brew my own, but I feel like some people are still a bit scared of the idea of kind of having scobies in their house.
It's the best.
And what was the other one? Kefir.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you do that. Do you do water kefir or?
Both.
Both, okay. That's one thing I haven't got into yet, because I don't think you can leave it as long as kombucha. Kombucha you can kind of do and then walk away for a couple of days, but kefir, it needs daily attention, I think.
Well, our milk kefir's got a quick turnaround, so it's ready in 2 days. But you either make it or you don't.
Okay,
if you're around.
Okay.
The water kefir, it's been sitting in the fridge for a little while.
See how it tastes.
It doesn't really go off. If it dies, it dies. But they're all kind of like, I mean, the modern diet or the industrial diet is missing like a lot of, nutrients and probiotics and many things like fiber, but these are things that we can replace in our diets just through fermenting a little bit of food at home.
So you would always advise that as opposed to kind of taking a probiotic?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the science, but from what I understand, they're nowhere near as effective.
Okay.
I recently ran some panels at the Good Life Experience, another festival with Sandor Katz, who is really the kind of godfather of fermentation and is a genius. So I learned a lot from kind of working alongside him. And his kind of advice was, you know, these probiotics can be good. And, you know, I think the pharmaceutical industry would argue that, you know, they're transparent to about what you're receiving. Mm-hmm. They tell you how many particles or probiotics they're, you know, how strong they are. But the reality is you can literally kind of mix up some cabbage with a tiny bit of salt and leave it for 4 days, and it will be a very intense and delicious probiotic.
Mm. And definitely cheaper. Because probiotics are really expensive.
It'll cost you pennies.
Yeah. Whereas a probiotic, good probiotic, costs normally like £1 a day.
Yeah. I think they're just incomparable in terms of the benefits you get. So just like a little, you know, a spoonful of sauerkraut or cider vinegar. I make a lot of my own cider vinegars, actually. I would say that should have come in the top three recipes
in
the book.
You can have four. Okay, we can. Oh, that's cool. So you've got, was my next question. Have you got kind of recipes for sauerkraut and
all of these? Yeah, everything we've just been discussing. Yeah.
It's all in there.
Yeah, and the cider vinegar is my new favourite waste recipe literally scraps of unsprayed or organic apples and some water. And a little bit of sugar, and then a tiny bit of cider vinegar just to start it off, but it's literally minuscule. It's like a starter on a sourdough.
Okay.
And it's just, you know, it takes a while, but then you've just got buckets of like this incredible ingredient that cost you virtually nothing to make.
Also satisfying to have made it yourself. I think there's something, again, it's all about that kind of having made it with care that I think just is equally as nourishing as the, if the ingredient's good.
Yeah.
Although, I'm so excited.
Yeah. Thank you.
So last question. Three ultimate dinner party guests, alive or dead, for this one.
Reni Redzepi, Francis Moorman and Dan Barber.
Cool, yeah. Cool. That would be great. Be chefs, a lot of food chefs waste all round. Chat as well.
Yeah.
Gosh, what would you cook? Precious on.
God, I hadn't thought about that. I wonder, what would I cook? I'd want to do something just real. I'd want to cook with them.
Yeah, that would be fun, actually.
Maybe just get
and
a fire.
And actually forage and stuff with them as well.
Yeah, get a fire, like light a fire outside, mm-hmm. kind of have that dinner party in the woods.
Yeah, nice.
And just kind of bring a load of incredible produce for everyone to play around with.
Fun, and your cider vinegar and all the ferments. Thank you so much. That's brilliant. So the book is out in March this year. And until then, where can people kind of keep up with you and what you're doing?
Well, the best place is actually Instagram, which is at Chef Tom Hunt.
Mm-hmm. That's the best place. And then you have your website, which is it Tom's Feast or is it Tom Hunt?
Tomsfeast.com.
Okay, because that's got loads of information on it as well about everything.
Yeah, there's past articles and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for that. That was lots of fun.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you liked it, rate it, review it, talk about it, share it, and invite your friends round for supper. This has been a Studio 71 production. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.